The medium is the message, money makes a dance. Love is the product, the joke is in, the joke is in, the joke is in your pants.
I'm Are You Serious? And this is my show.
Sort of the interest in pornography and sex workers sort of migrated from Paris over to Germany, where it got more tied into S&M.
Sex tourism was the third or fourth industry of Berlin. So when the Nazis came to power in 1933, they couldn't get rid of it, or they would have a financial catastrophe.
Sure. It's interesting also, I mean, you describe it as having a liberating aspect to it in terms of gender identity. And also there's this girl power thing going on.
There were 14 different kinds of lesbians.
Wow. Yeah.
But she was actually Miss Moneypenny from the James Bond movies.
Mm.
Marilyn Manson thought I was going to sue him because his last CD, The Age of Grotesque, is based on voluptuous panic. Hitler hated makeup on women. So the prostitute stopped using makeup. Lesbians become important for the war effort. The color of the boot and the color of the shoelace would determine what kind of sex you were paying for. And a lot of Dietrich's ideas, like dressing in male attire, are Berber inventions.
We're back with more of that good German decadence and Mel Gordon this week. But before we talk to Mel Gordon, we're going to talk to Jeff Diehl, Steve Robles, and, of course, the forever overcoming her wicked addictions, Diana Brown.
Thank you, Are You. And, you know, we are going to be talking with the fabulous Mr. Gordon, but we're not going to be having schnitzel because I have discovered that cheesesteaks are all in the news lately. I'm sure everybody else has been up on that. And apparently a cheesesteak by any other name would not taste as sweet, or so believe the folks at Gino's Steaks. This is a little cheesesteak shop located in the heart of Cheesesteak Central, ground zero for cheesesteaks, in the South Philly neighborhood. A very large immigrant population is there. And Gino Steaks has posted small signs telling customers, "This is America. When ordering, speak English."
I think you'll find that most old school immigrants, they really were into the idea of assimilation. My father, when he was born in this country, but he was first generation Mexican American. And he wants these people to speak fucking English too, because you know what? God damn it, he had to fucking learn it. And
I'm really sick of hearing people ask for cheesesteaks in Chinese.
Yeah,
I was
thinking, who the fuck is coming into this place that ordering cheesesteaks
something other than Chinese.
South Philly? I mean, you just go, hey,
well,
fucking cheesesteak.
That's
all right?
Exactly right. It's not exactly like they're speaking the Queen's English there.
Oh, say cheesecake in Spanish, please. Can anybody?
Queso bistec, I think.
El carne del queso.
Oh, that is pretty confusing.
That is pretty confusing. But, you know, they say they will not turn anyone away, and they're happy to teach people how to order in English. But, you know, I'm thinking about this. The local dialect of the native Philadelphian. So, you know, it's going to sound more like, yo, give me a cheesesteak with, will you, versus a cheesesteak with onions, please, you know, standard American dialect. So then I was thinking, okay, well, what if what kind of English does he want? If my Texas relatives came in, they'd say, well, why don't y'all get me a cheesesteak there with some of them onions? I mean, what if I went in there and ordered in Old English? It would be something like, you know, "Seis eit wid seip eingor wid seis garlder goftig ablelisen, please."
I would recommend that we take a trip to South Philadelphia and attempt to order cheesecakes.
Yeah, in a Chaucer steak.
English.
Now, I will say, if you are ordering from the owner and you will recognize this man by his tattoos and the giant diamond earring,
Mom,
do not ask for French fries, because Joseph only sells freedom fries.
We are back once again with Mel Gordon, and he's the author of many amazing and interesting books, the most recent one being The Seven Addictions and Five Professions of Anita Berber. And last week we were talking about Anita Berber, and we were talking about Weimar Germany. My German accent is not too great. One part in the book, you were describing how sort of the interest in pornography and sex workers sort of migrated from Paris and sort of sweet kind of vanilla sex, heart and flowers thing, over to Germany, where it got more tied into S&M and what we would call more perverse and more varied forms of sexuality. Is there something you think in the German character or in that particular moment that made them susceptible to that?
Yeah, one of the things I tried to avoid was making, unsupportable statements, because my background's in hard science, and very few people writing about this particular topic come from that world, evidently, and that was part of what fueled me, of having new things to say and to think about. And this is looking at statistics. So Paris had always been a sex capital since the 1860s. It actually had a brief two-year period of no censorship whatsoever in that period. And sort of, particularly after the Franco-Prussian War of 1871, Paris was the place to go to get kicks you couldn't get in your home city, wherever that was. And what happened was, in the year immediately after World War I, Berlin supplanted Paris, but also the German character was quite different. There were a couple things. One is this notion of classification, and the idea of what pleasure is for even seemed to be quite different. So let's suppose we're typical sex tourists going to Paris in 1920. Well, what you'd probably do is get off that train station and check into a hotel, go out, have something good to eat, have something good to drink, maybe engage with a prostitute or go to a brothel, depending on your finances, then go to a cabaret or a music hall review show, and then maybe you'd have another drink and maybe do something erotic. And that would be your evening. All pleasurable, all fun, all something you couldn't get in your home city. In Berlin, that wouldn't exist at all. In Berlin, you'd get off your train station and you'd have to buy a guidebook, because in Berlin, instead of just looking around for sexual intrigue or adventure, that you'd have to discover it depending on your interests. Let's suppose you're a neck fetishist. Now, if you'd gone to Paris, you'd have to spend a long time figuring out where you're going to get this satisfaction, where in Berlin, you could go to any book, would tell you exactly which of the 450 lounges to go to, what it would cost, what kind of food would be there. Food wasn't a primary concern of a tourist going to Berlin. And
it's all Wiener Schnitzel.
It's a regular Zagat guide, isn't it?
Well, there were a lot of these, and this is actually how I wrote Voluptuous Panic. And one of the reasons that scholars in Germany have never done this, that, of course, none of these books exist in libraries.
The thing I love about Voluptuous Panic, actually, was how the Germans love to categorize things. And you had, like, all those different categories of prostitutes in there.
Yeah, I forgot the exact number, but it's something like, for heterosexual prostitutes, I think there are, like, 32 different kinds. And the kinds were very specific because they each had a completely different function, of course, of what, yeah. But beyond that, they were identifiable by their dress, because in Berlin, you couldn't advertise by word of mouth of that you're a prostitute, so you had to dress like a prostitute of a certain kind. My favorite were, and of the hundreds of thousands of prostitutes, there were 400 of one variety called boot whores. And the boot whores were a kind of local color tourist attraction, because they were so specific and so funny that they were only on one corner of one street, and there were a lot of guidebooks. I have one book that's just for boot whores. And why you needed this book is because the color of the boot and the color of the shoelace would determine what kind of sex you're paying for.
It's like the hanky code.
Exactly like the hanky code. So for
what
instance,
kind of sex could
and
you
I
get?
Wrote, yeah. For instance, if the prostitute had this kind of poisonous green lacquer boot, high heel boot going almost up to the knees, and gold shoelaces, it meant that you're in for an evening of discipline, mostly verbal insults. And the gold shoelace meant a scatological conclusion. She would shit in your chest. And so that's rather specific, I thought. And when I found the guidebook to boot whores, which it was so funny with pictures and photographs, and you'd need one of these to, if you weren't a regular, to decipher what the hell you were getting. And but Oliver
Berlin. It would be tough to make a mistake. Actually.
It would be horrible to make a mistake.
Put on the wrong laces that day. Oh.
Yeah, and yeah. So and but the funny thing is about the prostitutes in general. Their fashion was so provocative, like Anita Berber's and others, that fashion houses almost immediately, within a season or two, would begin to imitate this for normal Berlin women. And so the prostitutes would have to find a different fashion to advertise that they were prostitutes and not just women walking their dogs in the street. And so this was fascinating because one of the many things I was able to do, because so much was written in the period, there was one sort of Walter Winchell wise character whose nickname was Rumpelstiltskin. And Rumpelstiltskin wrote for provincial German newspapers about life in Berlin. And one of the things he wrote about the popular culture, the political culture, but also about the sexual culture. And I was able to follow week by week what was going on, what was the new fetish, like leather ties or lipsticks he went crazy for, or different kinds of stockings or different kinds of shoes or this and that. And Rumpelstiltskin was this fascinating old character, and he'd bring his wife with him. On these prostitute bummels, as they say in German, or these sort of walks around the city. And sometimes he'd bring his funny-duddy uncle from the provinces who'd get everything wrong. He'd bring him to the most outrageous place of that season. So my favorite story is he brings Uncle Arthur to the largest transvestite house, where all the men are dressed as beautiful women with these outrageous costumes and hairpieces and so forth. And Rumpelstiltskin asks his uncle, do you think those are men or women? And the uncle gets it exactly right. He says, neither. He says, they're characters out of fairy tale books.
Oh, that's
and,
lovely.
Yeah, it's absolutely extraordinary that the uncle understands something that he's supposed to be the butt of a joke.
Right.
But
right.
instead he overcomes the whole comical thing and sees what it really is. And when you look at the photographs, of the transvestite denizens, he's exactly right. They look like characters out of fairy tales. And anyhow, Rumpelstiltskin also felt, I'm reading every week, you know, from 1919 onwards. And then the Nazis come to power. And how Rumpelstiltskin, this liberal writer, begins to accommodate himself to the Nazi takeover is absolutely fascinating. Mm. The first thing he says is that the swastika is a very beautiful sign. And he says the colors of the Nazi flag, which would be the new colors of Germany, of red, white, and black, are much more beautiful than the old colors. Hmm. And he says, and the Nazi uniforms are actually quite smart. And Hitler hated makeup on women. So the prostitutes in the summer of 1933, instead of disappearing, stop using makeup. And they start wearing sort of mannish leather overcoats in the summer, and different kinds of stockings and boots, and freshly scrubbed faces. So Rumpelstiltskin writes about this, and he says, you know, this is much better because we can see whether they have syphilis or not because they're not covering up with makeup. So I'm following how the typical Berliner begins week by week to understand Nazism is true. And he says, you know something? When the Jews, before they went on their vacations, before the Nazis were here, it was very hard to get a good a table at any one of these 300 restaurants. But now it's quite easy. The Jews aren't here. They're all in Budapest, Paris, or Vienna.
So the tradition to fascism in terms of
everyday life.
Fascism.
And then he says, now that they're selling their apartments for the first time, you know, you can live rather cheaply. So it's the way people really behave. It's a little bit like when it's what's lost today on the political debate on immigrants in America, of how people are really thinking about how it affects them. Mm-hmm. Right. If you can afford a live-in nanny, it's a disaster. This new policy demonizing and tagging immigrants. But if you're a working-class American, you're seeing it quite differently and so forth. And Rumpelstiltskin actually shows, in a way that I've never seen, week by week, how Gentile Berliners, who are very liberal, begin to accommodate themselves to the new political situation. Rumpelstiltskin commits suicide, by the way.
It's also just interesting the way people roll with fashion.
Important, and this is one of the reasons I think my Voluptuous Panic book, for a little publishing house, is a big success.
Right.
For one thing, it's about instead of writing about Germany, which there are lots of books of that period, none of them explore the popular culture and what it looks like. And this is one of the things that I've noticed that kids now have Neil Weimar parties. I was invited to several of them. Yeah. And some they tried to keep me away. They thought I was going to sue them. And Marilyn Manson thought I was going to sue him because his last CD, The Age of the Grotesque, is based on Voluptuous Panic. And when he called me wanting to know what I was going to do, I started laughing hysterically. I said, Manson, you don't get it. I'm a Berkeley professor. What could be a greater compliment than a popular CD based on an academic book that I wrote? It doesn't get better. No, I'm not going to sue you.
Well, speaking of music, we'll break and hear some tunes and hear a tune, rather, and come right back.
Are you serious?
Oh,
We're back with Mel Gordon. By the way, what did you think of the Marilyn Manson?
Fascinating to me, and what's it? Dieter von Teese is copying illustrations in Voluptuous Panic that, without crediting them, but you know, that's okay too. I'll credit myself. And what's interesting is how fashion and music want to come back in time. And this is what Moulin Rouge was about in part, the fashion of turn of the century Paris that speaks to kids. And this is also how history is understood. And I think that's okay. The funniest experience that I had personally was I was invited to one of these neo-Weimar evenings in San Francisco at a fetish club. So I came, and everyone was decked out in their versions of Weimar fetish. And then there was a striptease that was by a good-looking woman, about 22, 23, and some other funny entertainments. And after she did the striptease, she came up to me and wanted to know, was it right? I said, what do you mean? She said, was it right? I said, well, darling, they had no concept of striptease in Weimar Berlin. That striptease is an American invention. I'll give you an apple or I won't give you an apple. That in Berlin, they had lots of nudity on the stage, but it worked in a completely different narrative. Typically, it would be like a Marlene Dietrich. A couple of women would go for a picnic, and a hurricane would come and blow their clothes off. And men would come on the stage in a little sedan and so forth. Yeah, yeah.
Like that, yeah.
So as she's listening to me and writing this down, I realize she thinks that I was in Weimar Berlin in 1930. I realized that, you know, I'm much older than her, but not that much older, and. That the concept of time, I see this all the time with Berkeley students, is very, very weak. And then I think that when I went to school in the 1960s, that the relationship to Weimar Berlin was roughly their relationship to the Vietnam War.
Right.
That's how much time has passed.
Yeah.
Old-timers like me, you know, boomers, don't see that at all because they're not really aging correctly. They took drugs and so forth. But that's how much time has passed. Mm-hmm. And for them, Weimar Berlin and Vietnam War, they don't know which came first.
Right there. It's all very far away. Those were desperate sort of economic times in Germany, and that played into moving into prostitution. But it's interesting also, I mean, you describe it as having a liberating aspect to it in terms of gender identity. And also there's this girl power thing going on.
Absolutely. Yeah. So that it's part of this, and I'm giving a lecture related to this in Bijou's dancing, a few dances. This is on July 12th at the San Francisco Performing Arts Library. We're doing an evening called Flappers, Femmes, and Vitriol. And it's really about is this new scholarship in what flappers are, who began really before World War I as Paris flirts, and how those became internationalized after World War I of what a woman was and what she looked like and what sex was about. And the prohibition of alcohol was also the prohibition of, or put in a kind of comical way, the idea of generational struggle, of what life is about and what families are about and so forth. Everything that we talk about today really begins in the 1920s. What was fascinating and shocking and surprising for me in Weimar Berlin is how modern everything was and how it almost got lost. One of the reasons I wrote these books that I'd worked with people who are teenagers in Weimar Berlin. And one the wildest woman I know, I taught acting with, Felicity Mason was her name, was second cousin of Queen Elizabeth. And she was one of these people who thought she was Sally Bowles, that she knew Isherwood. Uh-huh. But she was actually Miss Moneypenny from the James Bond movies. That she worked with Ian Fleming in World War II, and was one of these pretty women who worked secretly in British intelligence in New York City and in the Bahamas. And she was, when I taught acting with her, she was always talking about Weimar Berlin, and I was interested in it, but I couldn't visualize what she was talking about. She worked in, one of the few women, in one of these transvestite lounges called the El Dorado Club. And she would say, the El Dorado was magnificent, and I used to sell my kisses and things like that. But I couldn't visualize exactly what she was referring to. And that, she was one of the inspirations when I got a book contract to write about Weimar Berlin, is to check with her what it was like to be a woman in 1931-32 Berlin. Mm-hmm. And everything she told me was surprising and different than what I would have thought. And it really was a kind of sexual enfranchisement of women. And the thing that was most surprising, I knew a lot, of course, about gay life through Isherwood, but lesbian life was sort of lost. And this was even bigger than a queer male subculture, that the lesbian subculture was so complicated. And they had 85 completely different lounges. And you talked about the divisions. There were 14 different kinds of lesbians.
Wow.
Some of whom, they all had their own magazines, so I could follow their cultures. And they dressed differently. They had different sexual tastes, completely different literary tastes and activities. And they had their own chess clubs, their own theaters, their own lottery schemes. Everything was different. And they wrote about it and published a lot about it. And so I was able to follow this and to write about it, including fantastic fashion decisions. Some had monocles and mini skirts and stuff like that.
Oh, I loved the monocle look.
Yeah, the dodos.
Berber, adopted.
Berber invented. The other thing is that the Berber book is interesting, that a lot of things we identify with Dietrich, there's usually two women identified with this period, Lotta Lenya, who loved Berber and wrote a lot about her, and Dietrich, who's actually a lover of Berber. And a lot of Dietrich's ideas, like dressing in male attire, are Berber inventions. And Berber was this wild woman, and Dietrich was actually this sort of laid-back revue dancer who stole a lot of ideas from Berber of what is art, what is the purpose of art, how sex wants to percolate through this art and shock us of kissing women in productions. Of course, Berber was doing it all the time,
right,
long before Dietrich.
I'm going to have to let you go, and thank you for coming. I want to ask one more question. And after the transition into Gnosticism, does some of this culture continue underground? Are there new, like, cultural ways that people identify one another and so forth?
This is also, as I said, I look for surprises when I do research. Uh-huh. And one was how sex tourism was the third or fourth industry of Berlin. So when the Nazis came to power in 1933, they couldn't get rid of it or they would have a financial catastrophe.
Sure. Uh-huh.
So it went underground up until the 36 Olympics. And it's after the 36 Olympics that everything begins to radically change in German life. Oddly enough, that lesbians are not ever incarcerated for being lesbians in Dachau the way gay men were. Lesbians become important for the war effort. That these are very active women who are good in nursing and for militarizing, especially for the war effort.
Which concentration camp commandants? When they were Alina Wurtmuller?
The thing was, it's a complicated, and the thing that shocked me the most in all of this, in 1945, when the Allies accept the surrender of the Nazis, what do they do with all these homosexuals in concentration camps? They keep them there because it was illegal for men to be fucking other men in France, Britain, in America.
Jeez.
So for several years, and this shocked me, and I was going through American documents in Maryland, what to do with gay men became a major issue.
After
the war, we think of everyone's liberated, but these people were not liberated from the concentration camps.
And what happened to them? They just left them there to die?
Eventually, they were released and identified. And to this day, the records, I guess it was just this year, were finally released. That this idea of the Nazis killing gay liberation is true, but so did other countries, including the Allied countries.
Well, we could go on about this forever, and we're going to have you back. I want to learn more about Hitler's clairvoyant. I haven't had a chance to read up on that. I want to thank Mel Gordon for coming in today.
Thanks for having us. This is a lot of fun. And one of the pleasures of doing a book that's a little different than a stage production where I started this stuff is that you get to hang on and promote a book where you can't promote a production that's long gone. Right. So thanks a lot.
Okay, this has been the Are You Serious Show. Thanks.
Love's the only weapon. Shit!